What surprised me on the other side of the coin was the stiff, closed-mindedness of many North American archaeologists. Just finishing my PhD in Peru and moved down to Chile during the dictatorship years of Pinochet. So I was opening up anthropology department. So politically, it was difficult at that time. And another colleague who sent a letter to the newspaper in Chile, one of the major newspapers, saying that Monteverde was creation of the CIA to implant me down there. And, you know, that puts you and your family in a dangerous situation in a country like that at that time. It made me reveal that there's a small, not a majority, but a minority of people who will do anything in their power to defend their paradigm.
That's Tom Dillehay, archaeologist famous for excavating Monteverde and helping prove that Clovis I isn't true. Now, he faced a lot of personal attacks throughout that debacle, but this one in particular gets my attention because this is the kind of thing that could have gotten him and his family thrown out of a helicopter, right? I mean, Pinochet was a dictator well known for thumping people that he felt were potentially a threat to his power. So why did they do this? How did they justify that sort of thing? And why does Dillehay seemed to think it was only North American archaeologists that were doing this? You know, I think I've got an idea. If you read the title of this video, you probably have my idea now in your head too, but we'll pretend none of us know and we'll just keep going with the video. Hi, my name's Dan and welcome to Dedunking. Now, Tom is clear. He didn't experience this from other archaeologists, just the North American ones.
And I found that the scientists were open-minded. This includes archaeologists. We had Australian, Chilean, and Argentinian archaeologists working with us. Cumulatively speaking, those people, besides myself, probably had close to 100 years of experience amongst them. What surprised me on the other side of the coin was the stiff, closed-mindedness of many North American archaeologists.
Now, this is odd if you think about it. I mean, Chile isn't in North America, and Dillehay is getting all kinds of personal attacks. And they're not coming from the locals, they're coming from North America. That's kind of weird, isn't it?
Some of the North American colleagues were very difficult to deal with, and I think at times presenting a very unhealthy atmosphere. A letter was sent to a dean with anonymous signatures of about 24, 25 people saying this guy doesn't even have a PhD, a lie, of course. You should fire him from the university for what he's doing and so on.
Now, as many of you have probably deduced by now, the same sort of thing is going on with Graham Hancock. I mean, he's a Brit, right? But think of his main critics. Just off the top of your head, who do you think of? David Miano, Jason Colavito, Milo Rossi, John Hoops, Flint Dibble. And yeah, there's one guy with the British accent that criticizes him from time to time, but even he moved over here to do it, it seems. It's like there's a culture. There's some sort of a cultural thing here in North America that makes it where they're just a little bit more active when it comes to this stuff than other countries are. A lot more active when it comes to this stuff. And their colleagues, like, they cheer when these guys make arguments that are frequently ill-researched, a lot of times just flat-out dishonest. But they get a lot of praise and a lot of attaboys, and it's like this circling of wagons, and it's kind of a weird little culture. And I believe the reason for this culture of activism over integrity can be traced to the Society for American Archaeology and its perpetual busybody. From its inception in 1934, the SAA has had one foot in the political arena. Formed in the immediate aftermath of the Great Depression, the massive increase in available funding, coupled with the problems they were having stopping the looting and selling of Native American artifacts, created a perfect opportunity for the many smaller, state-based archaeological organizations to unite under the umbrella of the SAA. Money was pouring in compared to what it had been just a few years prior. To quote Carl E. Guth, one of the founding members of the SAA and its first secretary treasurer, "I do not recall the exact wording of the telegram, but it was a sensational call for help in finding reasonably competent supervisors to direct the work of some 1,200 laborers who would start archaeological excavations in the Tennessee Valley. At that time, most of us, in planning for a field season, were accustomed to thinking of terms in a budget of only a few thousand dollars and to plan on less than 10 laborers for each archaeologist." Compare this to 1928, just a few years before the Great Depression, and the Bureau of American Ethnology, an organization similar but distinct from the NSA, received $20,000 from the U.S. Congress for the year's work. But in 1929, with the Depression hitting hard, that funding was drip-fed. that $20,000 taking 4 total years for them to allocate. Now, like everyone else at that time, they didn't really have much extra money. But when all of this ended, there was a little bit of a gold rush for the funding, right? Because there was all this new available funding, and a lot of people had kind of had the back burner of their projects for the last few years, so there was a lot of applicants. And there was only 7 universities in the entire country at that time that offered PhDs in anthropology, so most of the people were amateurs. The vast majority of people that were doing this stuff were amateurs. Of course, this created issues, and one of the first things the SAA attempted to do was to standardize reporting and methodology amongst these amateurs. Now, controlling the funding was helpful, and the close relationship the SAA's founders enjoyed with the Smithsonian ensured that they would receive preferential treatment in funding, and this was used to help enforce their standardization efforts. Part of this package was the inclusion of the amateur archaeologists into the SAA itself, and the potential to exclude anyone perceived to be in violation of the organization's objectives. From the professional archaeologist's perspective, the inclusion of the amateurs was a bit of a mixed bag. They were certainly the most numerous and the most active, but they were also the most in need of proper education so they could, like, speak the same language as the rest of the archaeologists. A great example of the problem that this caused is voiced by M.R. Harrington, the first vice president of the SAA. "More and better data. I hold in my hand an exquisite specimen of the flint chipper's art. The form, the curious lengthwise grooves, tell me it is no less than a fulsome dart point, a relic of that distant day when primitive Americans hunted the mammoth and the giant broad-horned bison." But where was this choice specimen found? Alas, nobody knows. It came in an old arrowhead collection gathered here, there, and everywhere, without a scrap of data, by a Mr. So-and-so, now deceased. Doubtless the collector himself knew exactly where each treasured piece was found, but when he passed on, this information died with him, and so died any value the collection might have had for posterity. This very real concern created a desire to gatekeep the entire endeavor. With little accreditation to actually vet people with, the SAA took it upon themselves to kind of force people that were engaging in this archaeological stuff on the North American continent, at least, to toe a certain line if they wanted to get funding or be part of the cool archaeologist club. And while this was extremely noble in the beginning, it created the foundation for the issues that we see today. The SAA started out as a political organization, one with a focus on securing funding, utilizing social and governments to influence the community, and through these means, advance the field of archaeology. They had, and still have, an easy way to remove members who do not agree with their ethics, goals, and all of that sort of thing. In other words, they control the tone of archaeology in the Americas, particularly North America, and are perfectly capable and willing to exclude people that don't toe a certain line. Now, since they're such a politically oriented organization, there's a lot of times that they weigh in on things where they kind of step outside of their wheelhouse. They've talked to Congress and Senate and Capitol Hill and numerous other government organizations, and most of the time, they're more or less doing their job accurately, but every now and again, you'll see them getting way out into the political realm and really not talking very much about archaeology at all, which is why you'll get people like me complaining about them. Longtime viewers will no doubt have heard me complain about their letter to Netflix, where they cry Graham Hancock's Ancient Apocalypse series is a terrible, terrible thing. The archaeologists wanted Netflix to reclassify the program as fiction instead of a documentary as it currently is, and one of their talking points was the claim that this theory dated back to Ignatius Donnelly, a man who did have some seriously dated concepts of race. Now, this theory actually dates to about 20 years before Donnelly, to Charles Étienne Brizier de Bourbon and Augustus Le Plongeon. And I'm going to keep naming these guys every time it comes up because the SAA doesn't want you to remember their names, it wants you to remember Donnelly's name. And this dishonest portrayal of the past in order to forge a political narrative falls perfectly in line with the SAA's history. They have this very much the ends justify the means, it's okay as long as we get where we're trying to go attitude. Or to quote their bylaws directly, to engage in any and all lawful activities incidental to the foregoing purposes. Mistruths fall under this umbrella. Do you know what else would fall under this umbrella? Calling up a newspaper in a dictator-ran country and telling them that an archaeologist down there was a CIA plant because you didn't like the direction that he was taking the archaeology. That would also fall under this umbrella of anything legal, buddy, just make it happen. But these accusations of a pedigree of white supremacy, this opens them up to the same exact scrutiny. And I've spoken before about the sins of American archaeology, asking why Atlantis hunters get scrutinized for racism, but the far worse history of archaeology is ignored. And the answer is always, No, archaeology polices itself now. It does better. You guys aren't doing that. We are. But they have shown us, in my lifetime, that power means far more to them than Native American rights, and in the process, they've demonstrated that they still need policing in this area. We now have the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, NAGPRA, that allows Indigenous Americans to reclaim the material remains of their ancestors, and often the artifacts associated with them. Now, the roadway to passing NAGPRA was notoriously difficult, and the Society for American Archaeology was, well, it was frequently on the wrong side of history in most people's opinion there. In 1979, the Archaeological Resources and Protection Act was passed, and it was intended to secure, for the present and future benefit of the American people, the protection of archaeological resources and sites which are on public lands and Indian lands, and to foster increased cooperation and exchange of information between governmental authorities, the professional archaeological community, and private individuals having collections of archaeological resources and data which were obtained before October 31st, 1979. It was intended to stop the illegal looting of artifacts on these lands, but it was deemed too vague by the higher courts to actually be enforceable. So, quickly, the Native Americans, the archaeologists, and the museums involved were trying to pass another bill. Enter S-187, the Native American Museum Claims Commission Act. It was a failed bill that was put forth in 1987. It addressed not only the ineffectiveness of ARPA, but also attempted to sew shut some loopholes, specifically in mining and a few other natural resources gathering situations where ARPA was basically non-existent. The tribes sought to change this by enacting a body that would supersede the Secretary of the Interior, a body made up of a majority of tribal members. Now, obviously, this would ensure that the tribes would win most of the time when cases were disputed with archaeologists or museums. So the SAA shifted positions, complaining loudly of them being removed from the discussion around who had rights to the bones of the indigenous Americans. The SAA spokesman to the U.S. Senate, archaeologist Mark Leone, had quite the exchange with the senators, including the following. Speaking of the skeletal remains of indigenous Americans, but you are defending the holding of 18,000. Archaeologist Mr. Leone says, in principle. Then if that's the case, why don't we have museums with 18,000 Chinese skeletal remains, 18,000 Japanese skeletal remains, 18,000 Caucasian skeletal remains? Do we have any museums around here that maintain a collection of 18,000 Caucasian skeletal remains over the last 200 years? Do we? Mr. Leone responds, I beg your pardon, do we have? I've never heard of such a thing. There is no question that you can construct that question to be a racist statement, and no doubt, he's interrupted, isn't this a racist situation? Mr. Leone responds, if we define it as a racist situation, we have to define changing that as more important than whatever the scientific potential and the education potential of the collection is. This was 1987, not 1887, and the SAA is being called out basically for being racist on the Senate floor. And this is a far cry from where they try to portray themselves, right? But what's funny about this is how they consistently shift positions. When in 1979, when they were going to have all this power over this stuff, well, yeah, they're in on it, even with these big, massive loopholes. But when they find out it's not working well enough, they're in to try to help fix it until they're going to lose all the power. And all the power is going to end up in the hands of the tribes. No shortage of papers of people complaining about that from the late 80s. And then time goes on. We get Kennewick Man, and we eventually get NAGPRA passed. But along the way, they had to be called out for being openly, at the very least, not giving two shits about how racist they were being. And this is kind of a big deal for a bunch of people that are like, oh yeah, we're doing better now. We police ourselves. We nothing like you. We take care of ourselves. No, you don't. No, you don't. You have to be told. You have to be told when you are doing stuff wrong. And okay, yeah, that's 40 years ago. But we ain't done yet. Now, this final example isn't nearly as damaging as erroneously labeling somebody a white supremacist or CIA plant in a country ran by dictators, but it does show the hypocrisy and the absolute self-serving nature of the SAA, and it's far more recent. In June of 2020, the SAA published a note from the SAA Publications Committee on a selection of SAA publications on race, inequality, and decolonization. It invokes George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, expresses solidarity with Black Lives Matter, and offers some links to SAA-affiliated articles that are presumably on racism. But this has to be the biggest joke I've ever seen. I mean, I was going to write something funny to say here, but I'll just give you what they've got here, because keep in mind, this is a bunch of archaeologists that are like, oh, we got this racism thing that we're going to show some solidarity with, so yeah, we'll weigh in on that. And what do they have? a pertinent data. Spoiler alert, nothing. They're archaeologists. What the hell are they going to talk about with this? But let's go ahead and see what they went ahead and linked in this awesome thing to support Black Lives Matter. And we have discussions of race and racism in archaeology itself, discussions of the 1923 race riots, Native American issues, damage to the feet of African American slaves, and the best part, a pair of articles that define ethnicity and African American ethnicity, written by a dude that's whiter than me. That's right, their response to the death of George Floyd in order to show solidarity with Black Lives Matter is to post a bunch of links that have nothing to do with Black Lives Matter. In-house archaeology stuff, all kinds of garbage, just old stuff that came mostly before BLM was even a thing, right? This is just vulture-ish, man. This is just like, give us a few clicks off of this trending topic. This, to me, is reminiscent of when, like, David Bowie passed away, and for the next 2 weeks, you'd go on Marketplace, and you'd see a CD that last week was $5, and this week it's $30, and now the description includes RIP David Bowie at the bottom of it. Patently vulture-ish bullshit. Same stuff here. Come read my article where a white guy tells you what it means to be black. This is how we help decolonize archaeology. You can't make this up. Now, when a body is formed, oftentimes its founding philosophy can become a tradition. And in the case of the Society for American Archaeology, the activist roots of its inception have created a tradition of activists. Coupled with bylaws that allow them to do literally anything legal in order to promote the goals of archaeology, it's no wonder that when they see somebody as a threat to that they get underhanded and dirty as hell about it. It's not just encouraged, it's expected. And I'm going to be covering these guys again in the future, so if you enjoyed this, let me know down below. Let me know what other aspects of the SAA you would like to see covered. And thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. We will see you guys again very soon.